We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. This is the second hour of the show. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour, we will return to a subject that we have discussed many times on this program, and that is public education in this country and how it, schools, and student performance can be improved. And we have as our guest someone who is one of the country's leading historians of education, Diane Ravitch. She's a research professor of education at New York University. From 1991 until 1993, she served as Assistant Secretary of Education and also counselor to the Secretary of Education, Lamar Alexander. This was in the first Bush administration. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by the Clinton administration. She's the author or editor of over 20 books. Her articles have appeared in many newspapers and magazines. She's the author of a new book that we'll be talking about this morning, and the title is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, the subtitle How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. It is published by Basic Books. Certainly, she is someone who has been well known as a supporter of both school choice and also of high-stakes testing. She says at the time these ideas were new, she hoped that testing, accountability, privately managed schools would all work to transform education. However, she's now taking a different view, arguing that these strategies that certainly she once supported and many people supported may actually undercut good education. And she explains that in this book. And as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. In addition, you may send your comments and questions by email right to will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Professor Ravitch, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
I'm great. And you call me Diane.
All right. Very good. Well, you know, and having introduced you in the way that I did, I think one thing that I do want to give you the chance to make is that while some people, I think, in writing about this particular book have used some fairly dramatic language to describe your change in thinking, I think you would say that this was not abrupt. And that your concerns, you've had these kind of concerns about education reform, about No Child Left Behind. You've had these concerns now for several years.
Yes, this is true. I live in New York City, and I've been watching the evolution of mayoral control, which is, in New York City, it is very much like No Child Left Behind. It's really the mirror image, very, very strong emphasis on testing and choice. And I began expressing concern about what was happening to the schools as early as 2004 when I wrote a joint op-ed piece with the head of the local teachers union, Randy Weingarten. She's now the president of the American Federation of Teachers. And since then, I've been regularly writing critical articles about No Child Left Behind, about concerns about the charter movement and the direction it was taking towards privatization and for-profit enterprises. I've been blogging for the last 3 years at the major education journal, which is called Education Week. And my articles have all expressed the same point of view that's in the book. So when people write about the book and they say I've done a dramatic U-turn or a 180, they just haven't been watching what I've been saying over the past really 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
But I think the deeper point is that my interest has for many, many years been that I want all kids in America to be able to get a good education. And I saw choice and accountability as strategies that might promote that goal, but I concluded they were leading us actually in the opposite direction, not towards a high-quality education, but in many instances, especially with accountability, we're undermining education.
You know, here I've been doing this program for a while, and over the years I've had many conversations with different people about education reform, truly going all the way back to the early 1980s when the Nation at Risk report came out. That's the first time I remember actually having sat down and,
right.
And
so you're living history, like, as I am.
So it's something I've been talking about for a long time, and it seems that from time to time, fairly regularly, someone will come along with a new idea or maybe a set of ideas that seems like it's going to change everything, and maybe just the most recent, the enthusiasm for charter schools. So we do things. And maybe in some places, for some children, they do seem to work. But overall, there seems to have been very little change. And that makes me wonder, do we have to conclude that we really, truly, in spite of all the good people thinking about this and doing research, that we truly don't know how to make schools better?
Well, you know, what I've focused on throughout my many, I guess now 4 decades writing about education has been the whole idea of reform. Almost every book I've written has been about reform movements, and I wrote a book in the year 2000, which was a history of the 20th century, and it's a history of reform movements. Starting the beginning of the 20th century, you get reform after reform after reform. But what's different about this era right now is, in the past, reformers would say, we need to make our public schools better. We need better trained teachers. We need better educated teachers. We need a better curriculum. And we now have, for the first time, to my knowledge, a very significant number of people who say we need to get the government out of education and turn everything over to the private sector. And I've been part of, or at least I was recently, part of conservative think tanks, and that's a very strong strain of opinion, and it's fueling a large part of the charter movement, which is that if you could just get the public money turned over to private hands, not have a whole lot of oversight of how the public money is spent, we can somehow make the public sector as competitive and innovative and dynamic and da-da-da. But this is a whole new challenge to the future of public education. So I don't think it's that we don't know how to do reform, but we just keep looking for this magic bullet, this silver bullet, magic solution. Mm-hmm. It's going to turn everything around quickly. And what we've not had, and very few people are even devoting any thought to, is what are the lessons we can learn from successful nations abroad, you know, other countries that have really good school systems? They don't do this. They don't privatize their school system. They don't put all their eggs in the accountability basket. They don't test and test and test again. This is not the approach. And what we really need to improve our schools, and I guess I almost prefer the word improve rather than reform, because reform has almost become a tainted word, at least in my mind. We really need to have some long-term thinking about improving the education profession and strengthening the curriculum across the board for all kids.
Let's talk a little bit about curriculum. I think this is really interesting that I feel that now I'm hearing more and more people talk about that and talk about the need for having something like a national curriculum. I don't know the United States would ever have this in a sense that other countries do, because we have this very strong commitment to local control. But that perhaps does get to this question, what would that accomplish? And maybe then the larger question behind that is, what truly should be the role of the federal government in what a lot of people see is as an essentially local institution?
Well, I'm not sure that we will ever have a national curriculum, just because of the tremendous diversity of this country, and it's so difficult getting people to agree on if you just take the example of the recent struggle in Texas over social studies standards, and then try to get Texas and New York and California and 50 states all in the same room, even metaphorically or by email, and you can see it would be very difficult to reach consensus. On the other hand, I think that you could. I mean, I think that I worked on this in California, where we, this was 20 years ago, came up with a K-12 curriculum in history and social sciences that turned out to be, everyone could agree, there was a civil war. We need to learn the lessons of why it happened and what was the aftermath. And you could just go through the major, major turning points in American history, and for that matter, in world history, and come up with something where people on the left, the right, the center, college professors, and everybody said, yeah, that's right, that's something we should teach kids about. I'm not holding my breath waiting for that to happen at the national level, but I think the role of the federal government here might be to relentlessly promote the idea that the arts belong in every school. And by the arts, they mean that there have to be actual teachers who can teach the arts, that every child should have the opportunity to learn to play a musical instrument, that science is important in every school. That, in essence, I would like to see the Secretary of Education become the national spokesman for a strong, balanced curriculum in every single school. And that would be a very different role from the, what Arnie Duncan is doing today.
We have a caller here. We'd certainly welcome others. We have a couple, in fact. 333-9455, the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest, Diane Ravitch, is research professor of education at New York University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a former assistant secretary of education. That was in the first Bush administration. She's written a lot about public education in the United States. Her most recent book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. It's out recently. It's published by Basic Books. And now we do have several callers. We'll try to get as many people in as we can, of course. But callers will help us, please, by trying to keep your comments brief. Let's go to first to Spring Bay. That's the first person in line. Toll-free line right here, line four. Hello.
Good morning. I used to teach in the college level, and the thing that I noticed here in the last, maybe 10 years or so, is that so many of my students could not read at a grade level, and they were coming out of the high school and the elementary schools, I guess, not really being very good at reading. So that's one comment. And then another one, and this is an opinion I'd like you to maybe comment on. I just wonder if busing has outlived its usefulness. It seems to me that we might be better off to go back to the neighborhood schools where the school is more of the center of the local community, a neighborhood. Kids could walk to school. We would get rid of all of the expense of operating a bus fleet, paying people, gas, maintenance, insurance. Those kids are sitting on those buses, and it's not serving any kind of educational opportunity for them to be riding on those buses. They could walk, they could get some exercise, and get the schools back into the neighborhoods where the community could become more involved in it. I'll leave that on the table and see if, and I'll get off and listen to your answer.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's interesting that No Child Left Behind, the big focus is on reading and math. And in reading, there has been no change in student proficiency from 1998 to 2009. That just came out of the national testing scores. One thing that is totally not trustworthy are your state scores. Illinois is known to have, like New York State, vastly inflated state scores, and they're useless for tracking student progress. So if you look at the national test, there has been no improvement in student reading capacity, despite all of this emphasis on basic skills, at the eighth grade level, which is the last point where it's measured by national test. As far as the issue of busing goes, where there's a court order, there's a court order. You obey the law, period. But my book focuses on what's happening today where there's no court order, but where the model that's being pursued in places like Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, many other places is put schools into the free market, close down neighborhood schools, put kids on buses or subways or whatever transportation you have, and let them choose and get selected by the school and take their chances in the free market, finding a school they can go to. Behind the free market approach is the idea that students and families are consumers and there is no neighborhood school. Everything's on the basis of choice. So New York has closed down well over 100 schools. It's opened hundreds of small schools. Chicago has closed many schools, and kids are being moved from neighborhood to neighborhood. And there are many people who believe that this is a terrible idea, first of all, because it destroys social networks and social capital. And kids are crossing from the territory of one gang that knows them to another gang that doesn't, and that promotes violence. There is actually no evidence to support closing schools, especially neighborhood schools, because even though they have low scores, there ought to be an effort to improve the school rather than just close it and say, go to a different school or we'll open new schools, because if it's the same kids, the chances are that nothing else has changed and the new school will get the same results.
No Child Left Behind has been criticized for this reliance on testing in just two areas, math and reading, and the fact that the states got to set their own standards, so they ended up many states setting the bar very low. And then also there was criticism of this ultimate target of proficiency that was set that I think even at the time it was set, very few people believed was possible. So yeah. Now the Obama administration is talking about doing things differently, in some people's minds, not differently enough. Assuming that accountability is important, demonstrating student performance is important, how do you do that? What's the best way to do that?
Well, actually, the Obama administration is not moving very far away from No Child Left Behind. Race to the Top, which is right now their signature initiative, is, if anything, they're doubling down on No Child Left Behind. The first thing they're requiring states to do is to remove any barrier to the vast expansion of charter schools. This is going to mean more privatization, more for-profit entrepreneurs moving into the charter sector and taking over the lives of more kids. They're also saying that states that want to be eligible for that almost $5 billion in federal money have to be prepared to evaluate teachers based on the student test scores. If you thought that there was teaching to the test under No Child Left Behind, wait till you see the teaching to the test that happens when you tie test scores to teacher salaries. This is now moving in many state legislatures where they're trying to pass laws. There's one that was just vetoed last week by the governor of Florida. Another is moving through the Colorado legislature. I understand that Illinois may have already actually done this, but the idea is that teachers will get little or no credit for experience or for their education, but about half their pay will be based on test scores. And this is a terrible idea because teachers have really very little influence over whether kids even show up for school or whether they're teaching the same kids from the beginning of the semester to the end of the semester. Teachers are opposed to it, almost every single one of them. And this is being caused by the Obama administration. It's going to put more emphasis on test scores than No Child Left Behind ever did. So I don't see them moving very far away from what they're doing. Test scores, I think, are useful to have, but they're not useful when you start using them to punish and reward people because it changes the nature of the test. It becomes something where people are incentivized to cheat. They're incentivized to game the system. And the information that you get from testing becomes useless when you attach consequences to it.
Yeah. Well, that I think, again, you have joined with those people whose criticism of No Child Left Behind is that it is extremely punitive, that it stresses
right. Punishment.
That is, if you don't, you tell the schools, if you don't meet the standards, you won't get your federal funding. And now people are talking about things like, you know, if you don't meet the standards, then we'll just fire all the teachers. We'll close down the schools.
Right.
What is a better kind of incentive if it's not the big stick? What would be something more along the line of the carrot?
Well, I don't think that people should get either carrots or sticks for test scores. I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. I think test scores should be used for informational purposes and for diagnostic purposes. Then they have some validity. This is why I keep referring to the national test scores, because there are no stakes attached to them. No one takes the national scores and gives bonuses based on them or punishes anyone because the scores went low. If you don't have people who want to do the right thing for kids, then you have the wrong set of educators, and they should all be fired. But as long as you have people in the classroom who are they're there because they made a life decision that their interest is in helping kids learn to not just read and write, but introduce them to science and history and a whole range of things, then they can use that information to make things better for kids. And when you see a school that has very low test scores, I think it's abominable to call it a failing school. What you really need to do, or what states should be doing, is to send in teams of expert educators to find out why the scores are low. It may be that the kids in that school don't speak English, in which case you can't fault the teachers because the scores are low. You have to provide extra resources to teach the kids English so that they can even understand the language of the test. There may be other reasons, and it could be related to things having nothing to do with teacher effectiveness, but to simply fire the entire staff, as is happening now in schools around the country, is a ridiculous approach, and all we're going to do is destroy American education.
Yeah. One more thing, and I promise the callers who are holding, I'll get to them. As I said, I think that some people, when No Child Left Behind came out, they were very concerned, they were critical of this goal that all students would be proficient in reading and math by 2014. And I think you've said, and a lot of people have said at the time, we didn't really even believe that. Even then, we didn't believe that. Well, now the Obama administration is using new language. They're talking about college and career readiness, and they're pushing out the goal out to 2020. But really, though, is that really any different?
Well, it all depends on what punishments they plan to attach to college and career readiness. because I understand, I didn't hear it myself or see it, but several people emailed me, and they said that Arne Duncan was on CNN last weekend and said that there was no reason that you couldn't have 100% proficiency if you really, and that poverty was no excuse. That sounds exactly like President George W. Bush and Margaret Spellings. I don't hear the difference.
Is it possible to set any goal that 100% of children can attain?
No.
Let's go to the phones here. Get back to people who are listening. And our next person is in Geneva, and that's line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, you know, this is a crucial topic. I know a lot. There's a friend of mine who's a professor, or was, down there at your school in Illinois, and he was saying, and I see this in just the kids around here and my kids, is that they're not teaching, they're not stressing certain issues like reading, you know, the three, reading arithmetic and you know, the sciences. They're more worried that the board here is more worried about political issues like what you can say and you can't say, no Pledge of Allegiance in the classroom anymore. You know, basically trying to cater to some of the politics instead of getting back to the basics. I mean, things have changed so much in the last maybe 10, 15 years that it's insane. They're teaching kids stuff that should not be taught. And, that, you know, they always use the too many kids in the classroom. And I know a lot of people in my neighborhood are sending their kids to private schools because the public schools are just not handling what they should be able to. I grew up, I went through high school and college. I wasn't the best, you know, learning student, but I ended up going on and doing really good in college. I learned, I was in classes at 30 plus and never had a problem. So I don't know if they're using the overload in the classrooms for one excuse. Secondly, I know up here where I'm at now that every time they want to use, it's for the kids for to pass a referendum, it's not. The money has gone directly into administration and into teachers' pay, and nothing gets to the class. You know, like they're always saying, well, we don't have enough money for uniforms for the band, or we don't have any money for computers. I don't understand why they use that as an excuse when it's not. And I'm just curious if that's what you're thinking. I mean, I just think there's just too many political hands in the fire now, and it's not helping anybody. There's a lack of engineers. They just came out and said it. Nobody's going in engineering. Well, where are the engineering degrees going?
You laid a lot of stuff on the table there. Let's give the guest a chance to come in.
Okay. I think you have a broad range of concerns. One of them is that there's not enough focus on the basics. Actually, the focus for the last 8 years has been only on the basics because the only thing that counts is reading and math, and nothing else counts. The arts don't count. Science doesn't count. If we're not producing enough people in engineering, and that's absolutely true, in part it's because kids are not getting a decent education in science, and science doesn't count. So as far as where the money goes, education is expensive. It's gotten more expensive. Local boards should be watching the expenditures with a hawk eye, but I can promise you that turning things over to private businesses and to entrepreneurs who are trying to make a profit off education is not going to reduce the expenses. They will run a bare-bones operation in which they try to get a head count in order to increase their profits. So I think that we're going to have to have local boards take responsibility and bring in strong accountants and financial managers to make sure that the money is going where it should be going, which is to the classroom.
Although there are a lot of places where the local boards are really up against it, because one of the things certainly we've seen in this state, and I'm guessing that it is true in other states, is that over time the support that comes from the state for local schools, financial support, has eroded.
Yes. Well, you know, one thing that I would recommend is that the federal government, instead of trying to impose its ideas on everybody, the federal government should be paying the cost of special education. The federal government mandated all kinds of requirements for the states and the districts and the schools, and it has never paid what it mandates. Typically, the federal government puts up 12% of the cost, and the single biggest expenditure and the single biggest source of new spending over the past 15 or 20 years has been special education. So I think there would be widespread fiscal relief for everybody if the Fed simply pay for what they mandate. That would be a good start.
I think that as a lot of people are concerned about the quality of the teacher corps, one issue might, in fact, well, do we have enough teachers? But the other is the quality of the people who are attracted to teaching. And I think often people say, well, the reason that we don't have more people deciding to be teachers is that teachers aren't paid very well. And then other people say, well, that shouldn't really be an issue. What's your take on teacher pay and how that figures into all of this?
Well, I think that what typically, if you ask teachers, or if you look at the surveys of teachers, if you ask them what's the most important thing to them about being in teaching, they'll say, well, of course, they really want to be teachers. That's why they became teachers. They were drawn to being with kids, teaching what they knew. But the more important factor is working conditions. That teachers, I mean, you have to bear in mind about 50% of the people who become teachers leave within 5 years. So when people say not enough people are being fired, well, that's ridiculous. Half the teaching force that enters is gone within 5 years. And of those who remain, they are incredibly demoralized these days because of this negative attitude that's spread throughout the country, in part from race to the top. The Obama administration has gone around applauding the firing of entire teaching staffs without any evaluations, and the president himself, in addition to Secretary Duncan, has said, great, they fired the whole staff of Central Falls High School in Rhode Island. Well, they don't know anything about that school. They don't know anything about whether it's got good teachers as well as bad teachers. Maybe the whole staff is a group of heroes dealing with impossible situations, but nonetheless, you've got the president saying, fire the teachers. So given the negative atmosphere in which teachers are operating today, I think we're going to have a very hard time attracting the kind of people who should be in teaching because we're making it a very undesirable profession. And you've got legislatures all over the country now going on about how terrible the teachers are. I think it's once in a while it might be nice to say to teachers, thank you. You know, you're dealing with kids who are coming from homes that are in many cases dysfunctional, where parents don't teach behavioral standards to their children. You're told that you can't remove the kids who are disruptive, and you're expected to teach science. And it's just, for teachers, it's an impossible situation. I think that our country needs to get its head together and begin to thank the people who educate their children and stop complaining as much as we do, but also begin to have a longer-term vision of how to make teaching a more attractive profession, better working conditions. I'm not even talking about pay now. I'm just talking about respect, esteem, gratitude, and also we should expect teachers to have a major in the subject that they're going to teach. There's been too many people who go into teaching having a pedagogy degree and not having mastery of history and science and mathematics and literature and all the things that are going to be taught. And we should set higher standards for entry into teaching and at the same time establish, I would say, a greater deal of respect for the people in the classroom.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Diane Ravitch. She is research professor of education at New York University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. In the early 90s, from 91 to 93, she served as the assistant secretary of education and counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander. That was in the first Bush administration. She's authored many books. Her articles have appeared in many newspapers and magazines. Her most recent book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System. The subtitle is How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. It's published by Basic Books. On to some other callers here, and our next is line two, and that's someone here in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
Wow. Every time I hear something coming up here, I feel like I want to pump my fist in the air and say yes. I'm on my way to becoming a new teacher, and I do call in a lot. I'm going to have education as a topic on one of these. But I'm really interested in what you're talking about with testing. And in the course of the conversation, something came up, and I want to see if you would confirm this. One of the points, I came across a topic about mid-20th century opportunities for women. If you were an intelligent, professionally minded woman, you really had about three opportunities to expand. You could be a teacher, a nurse, or a secretary. But now, as women have been able to be freed up into the great grand majority of all professions, equity is still being a problem. But the quality of teachers goes down because women can do more things. So perhaps a teacher who at one point in time would have had an opportunity to do one of three things, now can be a doctor or a lawyer, that School of Intelligence kind of leaves the profession a little bit, and I'm just kind of curious about your take on that. I'm really liking what I hear you're saying about high-stakes testing having no place. I do believe in some testing, but it's unfortunate that it's implied so erratically. During my student teaching, there's an introduction of benchmark testing into the Champaign area, and this is the second thing I'd like you to address, the first one about women, the second about benchmark testing. The benchmarks were designed that the first test would be about the material to be taught all year, and about 25% is what they were hoping for. They take it again in the middle of the year. They'd be hoping to get about 50%, third time 75%, and hopefully 100% by the time the entire year has gone by and all the material has been taught. The unfortunate thing is I noticed that, and my cooperating teacher noticed this too, is that the teachers that did exceedingly well on the first tiers of the benchmark testing were accorded a lot of respect, and he was worried because he was the union rep that benchmark testing might be tied to merit pay, and students that beat the curve are now going to be rewarded. The trick is, though, this was benchmark testing. You know, you're supposed to be measuring a level of mastery within a student, and all of a sudden your test is no longer measuring what you're attempting. Anyway, I just wanted to hear your thoughts on benchmark testing in classrooms and also about the changing nature of the demographic of teachers.
Sure.
And I'm loving what you're saying so far. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. The first thing is that it's like a commonplace conventional wisdom to say, oh, the quality of the teaching force went down because women now can be investment bankers and doctors and lawyers and so forth. And that's possibly true. But in a way, that's been used to put down people who do teach and to say they're less intelligent than they used to be. And I think from my own experience, I don't think that's true. You could go into any school and you find incredibly smart people who are teachers, and you think, gee, they could have been college professors, but instead they've chosen to work with young children or adolescents. And I think that we should not accept that kind of caricature or stereotype and say, because the implication is we're not getting good people into teaching anymore, and it's simply not the case. As far as the benchmark testing goes, first of all, I think it's unlikely you'll ever get 100% of anything unless you have an incredibly low standard. If you lower the standard enough, everybody will be able to get there, but some kids are going to take a much longer time, and there will be if you have a real standard, some kids will never reach it, and you just have to help them as best you can, but that's the question of 100% proficiency. The other thing, which is tying merit pay and bonuses and sanctions to the test, is, I think, terribly wrong. And I've been corresponding with a Professor Harry Frank at the University of Michigan. He's now an emeritus professor there. And Dr. Frank said to me that whenever you tie sanctions and bonuses to test scores, you're going to get cheating and gaming the system, because you have to separate out the decisions, like who gets tenure and who gets rewards, from counseling. Counseling meaning, how do you improve your teaching? What can you learn from this test? So what we want to focus on with the test is the improvement function. What can you learn from the test? How do you help the student? And not make it part of the reward system, because then you'll learn nothing from the test. And this is why the biggest change in my own personal views is I think we have to totally detach rewards and punishments from testing of students, because they're just two totally separate items. The test designed to see if students are making progress are not designed as tests of teacher effectiveness, and we have to separate them. Otherwise, we're just going to get more teaching to the test, more narrowing of the curriculum, and more cheating.
Well, we do have this idea that somehow, and I guess I'm not sure how you get away from the idea that teacher performance and student performance are linked, and that means that some people would say, well, you know, look at the students that are doing the best. Well, that must mean that their teachers are the best.
Not true, because what you'll find is, first of all, teachers don't have classes that are randomly assigned. So a teacher one year may find that the class makes enormous gains. The next year, she gets a different group of students. No one makes a gain, or maybe only a third of the class makes a gain. Why? Different group of students. She may have some disruptive students who've made it hard for everyone in the class, and she can't do anything about it. So given the fact that, first of all, you don't have before and after tests, you're looking at tests that are given usually once a year on the state test. If you wanted to try to come up with some kind of a valid measure, you would have to have a test in September and a test in June and make sure that all the kids were randomly assigned to the classes so that you're comparing apples to apples. But since nobody does random assignment of students and every teacher has a different group of students from year to year, and teachers even in the same grade have different kinds of classes, it's not a fair comparison. And this is why the principal who's making the judgment about whether a teacher's any good or not has to be a master teacher. He or she, as the principal, should be really knowledgeable about teaching so that they can walk into the classroom and say, wow, you know, Ms. Jones, Mr. Smith, they really have this class under control. They know what they're doing. They really are good at teaching kids. That's the first thing. That's human judgment. They can also look at test scores, and they have to be before and after scores, September to June, September to May, and say, oh, dear, nobody in Ms. Jones or Mr. Smith's class ever learns anything. I guess I was wrong about my judgment. But, you know, you use the test scores as a way of confirming the human judgment, but you can't take the human judgment factor out.
We have several callers here. We'll try to get as many in as we can as we now move into about our last 15 minutes and go next to someone on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
My question for your guest is about the state of gifted education in the country and especially the identification process for that. I'll hang up and listen to her comments. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, tell me, what kind of education?
I think she said gifted.
Oh, gifted education. I think what's happened to gifted education these past 8 years has been a tragedy because under the No Child Left Behind law, there is no incentive to teach gifted children at all. The whole focus is on moving kids from, if there are four levels, 1, 2, 3, and 4, to move them from level 2 to level 3. Once you move that from level 2 to level 3, there is no incentive to advance anyone from 3 to 4 or to help the kids at level 4 achieve even higher because they're already in level 4, so why bother with them? So there is, in fact, under No Child Left Behind, a disincentive to pay any attention to gifted children. And I think any good education system is going to help kids move towards the things that are challenging to them, that are engaging, motivating, and we're not doing that.
All right. Next, Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I wanted you to talk about why this ideology is going ahead. It's part of free market fundamentalism, but there's also vested interest behind it. I think you call it the Billionaire's Boys Club.
Right.
And I wonder if you could say something specifically about Duncan in Chicago, too, because things have come up. You mentioned fabrication of results, and that's come up in a big way in Chicago. It's not being ballyhooed as much as it should. But another aspect of Duncan's reign that you may be able to comment on is that there are now 8 military academies at the high school level. What's the impetus for that? I mean, I think you probably have surveyed the evidence that these boot camps for problem high schoolers and older offenders, whatever, are not very effective either. They still have a big push behind them. Is there the Billionaires Boys Club? Are they as well as touting, you know, turnaround schools, reconstituted schools? Arne Duncan, obviously, his mother was a teacher, but he's basically a turnaround artist, a venture capitalist. So something on that. It's very frustrating.
Sure.
I appreciate your efforts.
Okay. You mentioned Chapter 10 in my book. It's called The Billionaire's Boys Club. What's happened is that we have two hugely important foundations that have decided that they know how to fix education, and they've pumped billions of dollars into their view of how things should work. There are actually 3 of them. The Walton Family Foundation, which is the Walmart family, that's very conservative. It spends its hundreds of millions of dollars promoting choice, vouchers, charter schools. Now the Gates Foundation, the Bill Gates Foundation, also the Eli Broad Foundation of Los Angeles, have joined in support with Walton for privatizing charter schools, evaluating teachers by test scores. This is the mantra of all 3 foundations. Arne Duncan has been very much part of this network because when he created this Race to the Top Fund, he hired somebody who was running the New Schools Venture Fund of California. The New Schools Venture Fund exists to promote charter schools. So the Race to the Top Fund promotes charter schools. Charter schools, in many cases, will be private, for-profit organizations. There are, in many parts of the country, foundations, hedge fund managers who see this as an industry that is very attractive to them. Public money and very little public oversight, in some cases not even a public audit. And the charter sector is growing by leaps and bounds. It's now 5,000 schools across the country, 1.5 million children. And with the Obama administration's support, it will grow even more rapidly. Why has this happened? It's happened, first of all, because these foundations fund the think tanks. The think tanks, both from the center and sometimes even from the center left, are putting out advocacy pieces for charter schools and teacher evaluation by test scores. The main newspapers in the country, the New York Times, the Washington Post, on which Melinda Gates serves as a trustee, the Los Angeles Times, are all echoing the same ideology. And so we have this free market ideology now becoming the mainstream dominant paradigm with very few voices raised against it. And, of course, the teachers' unions oppose, but they get dismissed out of hand as, you're only speaking for a vested interest. We don't want to hear your voice. You're discredited. So this is where the, you know, almost a kind of a right-wing ideology has become captivated what used to be the liberal precincts, and it's bizarre.
All right, I hope that gets to the questions of the call. Let's continue. Champagne is next, line two. Hello?
Yeah, excuse me. I have sort of an allergy, so it's the season. I don't know if you, I guess you can understand me, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. There's not often that I agree with a speaker almost 100%, but what you're saying, I do agree with you 100%. You know, what's going to happen to the poor? The poor has taken a beating all the way along in education. The biggest problem, we've never really adequately funded education. If you take Chicago, the northern suburbs, great schools, great teachers, all that kind of stuff. You get in and down in the, you know, the poorer areas, never had good schools, you know, in terms of a good environment, all that kind of thing. I actually taught in college. If it wasn't for public education, I never would have been able to go through school, go through and subsequently get a PhD. My family didn't have a lot of money. So, you know, the other one and the final one is that in terms of teaching, I certainly, you know, you can also teach to the student or the student-teacher evaluation, too. You know, that unfortunately went through this thing of making everybody happy. So I'll just end there and keep up the work. I would hate to see these things that you're talking about, the privatization. You know, we ought to really make a commitment to education. Yeah. So I'll just end there.
Well, thank you. And let me just say that one of the questions I keep raising, and I was in Chicago a couple of weeks ago and met, spoke at DePaul and University of Illinois and also Catalyst, which is a great research journalist organization, and the National School Boards Association. Met with a lot of Chicago educators. Everybody was there was saying Chicago has really not improved, and the test scores were inflated. There was a report last year showing that state of Illinois had inflated the test scores, and then when President Obama introduced Arne Duncan, he talked about these dramatic test score gains, but when they were examined by the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago, they said, well, you know, none of those scores were really meaningful. There was no big improvement in Chicago. So, yeah, we have a problem with not supporting education. The kids coming from the inner city are getting a far less quality of education than the kids in the wealthy suburbs. And the question I always ask is, why is it that banks are too big to fail, but we have to close schools? Why don't we improve them and take some of the money that have been pumped into these big investment banking firms where they're paying themselves multi-million-dollar bonuses and instead make sure that kids in the inner city are getting a high-quality education?
I want to get an email question in here because actually the listener raises something that's been in my mind right from the very beginning of the program where you said that maybe it would be a good idea to look at European schools, or at least schools outside the United States, to find models of success. And the listener wonders, can you name a couple of reasons why European schools outperform ours?
Well, it's not just European schools. Typically, people look at schools in both Asia and Europe, and the highest performing European school system is Finland. Finland has very little emphasis on testing. Kids don't take very many tests until they're ready to graduate from high school, and then they take tests to see if they can go to college. But Finland is a school system that has a very strong national curriculum. Of course, it's a small country. It's a homogeneous country, so you can say it's not like us, and it's a lot easier for them to do this. But the big emphasis on Finland is on having the highest quality teachers. They get that not by firing teachers, which is our approach, but by making sure that the induction and recruitment of teachers is very, very strong. They have high standards for entry into the profession. You have to have a degree in a subject that's going to be taught in school. And so they focus on having highly educated young people coming into teaching and then supporting them so that they become excellent teachers. And most people who've looked at the Finnish system say that the great secret of their success is excellent teachers. The same thing is true in Japan, where the focus is on improving teaching and giving teachers a lot of support to improve their skills throughout their career.
We have just about 5 minutes left. Our guest is Diane Ravitch. She's a research professor of education at New York University, former assistant secretary of education. Her new book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System. On to another caller, and this would be Urbana and Line 3. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'd like to touch on something you've examined very briefly, but over the last 40 years, there has been a steady decline in real income, particularly for the lower three-quarters of the population. I don't think, with the increase in poverty, that you can expect any increase in educational level. Children whose parents are desperately trying to make a living aren't going to do well in school.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you should tell that to Arne Duncan. You should tell that to Chancellor Joel Klein in New York City. You should tell it to Michelle Rhee. I write about this in the book, that these are people who say poverty is no barrier to achievement. And my response has been, in the book and in various interviews, that all the social science research for the last century has shown that the single most important predictor of low academic achievement is poverty. And yet, Duncan, you know, Rhee, Klein, all of these free market reformers say, oh, that's nonsense. You know, if you just have enough charter schools, we'll have 100% proficiency. And that's simply wrong. I agree completely with you that poverty continues to be a tremendous burden when kids come to school hungry, when they can't see the teacher or what the teacher is writing on whether it's a smart board or a chalkboard. That's a huge barrier. And you know, kids who are poor are less likely to attend school, and that's also a handicapped academic achievement.
May I say one other thing?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Everyone seems to think they're an expert on education, whether they've ever studied education or not, or even done well in school. I think this is a real problem, because the people that are trying to be educational reformers, and I put that in quotes, generally really don't know much about teaching. And therefore, I don't think we can hope for them to ever do well.
Well, I think you're right, but I think what's actually makes the matter worse is that the word education reform today, to me at least, has become a tainted word because there's so many people who are hedge fund managers who've never done anything in education other than go to school, who now consider themselves to be education experts because they've opened a charter school or they sit on the board of a charter school. And the people who actually work in schools, teaching ordinary kids or low-income kids, they have no voice in the conversation. So we have a national dialogue that has been determined by non-educators who have contempt for educators.
I want to get one more caller here. Thank the last. The next is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Professor Ravitch, thank you so much for all of your scholarship and work over the years, even though you do reserve the right to change your mind from time to time.
Thank you.
I'm anxious to know what your prognosis for positive change is, and let me put that somewhat positively. What would your scenario be for turning the Obama administration around so that we can move in the direction that you're describing? I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you.
That's a great question, particularly since we're near the end of the hour. First thing I would ask President Obama to do is to fully fund special education. That would immediately lift an enormous fiscal burden from every state and school district in the country. The second thing I would ask him to do is to begin long-range planning to change education, the education profession, and that is to put an emphasis, and not through federal mandates, but through sitting with the governors and the states and the legislatures and figuring out how do we improve the quality of the teaching profession so that when people enter teaching, they're not simply going in for 2 years and planning to leave after 2 years, but making a commitment to teaching as a career. and so that every teacher has at least a BA in the subject that he or she plans to teach, possibly even a double major, say history and the arts or science and literature. Secondly, that every principal should be an experienced educator and in fact a master teacher, because we're putting a big emphasis on teacher evaluation today, and the only tool that people are talking about is test scores, whereas what they should be talking about is having master teachers who are making the human judgments that are crucial in determining who's an effective teacher and who's not an effective teacher. And thirdly, we should have an education profession led by educators, and I'm talking about the superintendents. We should not be looking to have businessmen and lawyers running our school systems, but rather expert educators who themselves understand about curriculum, instruction, personnel. These are the key decisions. And if you bring in non-educators to make them, they're going to simply rely on data, and the data will be phony, and they won't even know it's phony because they don't have the experience to. I'd also like to see a big, big emphasis at the federal and national level on having a coherent curriculum, and not by having federal mandates, but by creating this vision of what good education is, and that it must include the arts and science and geography and history and literature and foreign languages, physical education and health. All of these things are part of a good education, and get away from this obsessive engagement with data when the data we know is so often manufactured and phony. That would be a good start. I can add a few more things. I'd love to see every student in American schools given the opportunity to learn to play a musical instrument. I say this not because I'm a musician, but because I think it would teach everything we want schools to teach: self-discipline, effort. You can't fake the results, and if you get to be good enough, you can do it with a group. So those are the things that I would focus on, and I would hope that I could persuade the president that's the right direction to go if we want to have a great education system. I'm afraid we're going to waste another 8 years as we wasted 8 years under No Child Left Behind.
Well, there we'll have to stop. I'm glad we got at least to some. We spent a lot of time, as we often do on programs like this, spent a lot of time talking about the problem and not quite so much on solutions. So I'm certainly glad we got at least that much in the end. And if people would like to read more of our guests' thinking on this, you should look for the book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, by our guest, Diane Ravitch, published by Basic Books. Diane is a research professor of education at New York University and was in the early 90s assistant secretary of education. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation.